This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, warns the entire human rights system is under attack, stoked by fears of terrorism and xenophobic rhetoric by populist politicians. The High Commissioner presented his annual report on the state of human rights around the world to the UN Human Rights Council.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next.
Also, today is International Women's Day, and the Gambia is still engulfed in deep political divisions despite the election of a new president.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, warns the entire human rights system is under attack, stoked by fears of terrorism and xenophobic rhetoric by populist politicians. The High Commissioner presented his annual report on the state of human rights around the world to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein highlighted recent human rights developments in more than 40 countries. Among this group, he notes only four countries, Gambia, Uzbekistan, Tunisia, and Greece, have made some improvements in human rights. Otherwise, his appraisal of the human rights situation globally is uniformly bleak. For example, he deplores the violence and destruction in South Sudan, where famine is spreading. He accuses the warring parties of repeatedly engaging in alleged war crimes, including killings, rape, and sexual violence, disappearances, and pillage. He says he's very concerned about the situation in Burundi, where the democratic space now has been virtually extinguished.
Grave human rights violations and abuses by security forces and the Imbonerakure militia continue to be reported, including increasing allegations of enforced disappearances, torture, and mass arbitrary arrests.
Turning to the Middle East, he condemns the bombs and other shocking terrorist attacks against civilians in Turkey, but expresses concern about government measures under the state of emergency, which appear to target criticism, not terrorism.
The fact that tens of thousands of people have been dismissed, arrested, detained, or prosecuted following the attempted coup, including numerous democratically elected representatives, judges, and journalists, raises serious alarm about due process guarantees being met.
The High Commissioner also finds fault with several of the world's superpowers. He criticizes China for detaining lawyers and activists who fight for the rights of others. He deplores Russia's curbs on political dissent, freedom of expression, and religion. In the United States, he expresses concern about President Trump's vilification of entire groups, such as Mexicans and Muslims. He warns the collective expulsions and deportations of immigrants could be breach of international law if undertaken without due process guarantees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, since the early 1900s, International Women's Day has been a day to globally celebrate the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women. The day also marks a call to action for accelerating gender equality. This year, the theme is hashtag Be Bold for Change. Women and men are being asked to help forge a more gender-inclusive world. Some African migrant women have already been taking the task to heart. They held a press conference in Rome, Italy, to let the world know that International Women's Day is their day, too. Reporter Josephine McKenna was at the press conference. She spoke with me about the experiences the women shared with her that included surviving human trafficking during their journey from Africa to Europe.
The press conference was held in Rome, and it was called We Are Also Women. And that was really an opportunity for African women migrants in Italy to say International Women's Day is also their day, and they wanted to notify people about their participation and their rights on this very important day.
What exactly did some of them say about their rights in Italy?
Well, we heard some fascinating stories. Princess Okokon from Nigeria is a survivor of human trafficking and sexual slavery. She came to Turin via London in 1999, and she was forced into sexual slavery, prostitution. She spoke about how she was beaten, she was threatened. She was even hospitalized for a week because she was so badly beaten and tried to escape from prostitution rackets. She was eventually saved by a man who is now her husband, and they run a support center in the northern Italian town of Asti to help other migrant women who are trying to escape from prostitution rackets. Now, she said that there's no work in Nigeria and it's very, very hard for female migrants to avoid prostitution when they arrive in a place like Italy without a visa and without the language. Their center is trying to offer survivors who escape health insurance, health assistance, legal aid to help them confront their traffickers in court, and other kinds of support, courses to help them develop some kind of work, whether it's being a waitress or being a housekeeper, just to get them started. And often these women are forced to try and pay out of a contract to get them out of prostitution. This is so important to give women an alternative life and a new way to build a future in a place like Italy.
Also, you have another experience there with a woman who was originally from Somalia and who has now been living in Italy for quite some time. Can you tell us her story?
Ijaba Shego comes from Somalia. She came to Italy with her parents in 1989, and she sees herself completely integrated. She's the author of books in Italy, and she's determined to break down barriers. She wants people to stop dividing these voyages across the Mediterranean into legal and illegal categories. And she's also fighting for citizenship, because many migrants who come to Italy are denied citizenship, not only themselves, but also their children. So children who can be born here to migrant families can grow up here completely integrated in Italy and consider themselves Italian are denied citizenship and forced to live as foreigners without their complete rights. And there is a law in the Italian Parliament that's been blocked by opponents, particularly by the Anti-Immigrant Northern League, which is using proposed amendments to try and block this bill that would give migrants greater rights.
What have you seen as the overall response to these African women migrants in Italy?
There was a huge response today from Italian and international media coming to hear their stories. We also heard from Habiba Ouattara from the Ivory Coast, who fled the country through Ghana to come to Italy. We also heard from Agitu Ideo Gudeta from Ethiopia, telling us how impossible it is to survive in Ethiopia because of government repression, and how she was forced to leave her own country. So amazing stories here of escape and survival, people building a new life. And I think Italians in general have not heard enough about these positive stories. We've heard so much about the trauma that people are suffering when they cross the Mediterranean, mistreatment in Libya, the dangers on the voyage across the Mediterranean. But to hear these positive stories about women in particular who are learning the language, building careers, studying, taking courses, and trying to build a new life in Italy was truly inspiring today.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
On International Women's Day, UN agencies are calling for greater efforts to ensure gender equality and end hunger and poverty. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, and UN Women say that millions of rural women are key agents of change in building a world without hunger. José Graziano da Silva is Director General of the FAO.
Women play an important role in agriculture and in food systems, not just as farmers, but also as processors, traders, and managers.
The UN agencies say women make up as much as 60% of the agricultural workforce in parts of Africa and Asia. Nevertheless, they say that women do significantly more unpaid work than men, such as caring for families and communities. Graziano da Silva says women face major constraints in rural labor markets.
Women are more likely to be in poorly paid jobs without legal and social protection. This limits women's capacity to advance their skills, earn incomes, and access to employment opportunities.
Other obstacles include gender-based social norms, laws, and practices that can limit their access to land and education. The FAO chief says the UN agencies have joined forces to develop programs supporting rural women.
This program aims to capacitate rural women to better manage and expand their businesses. This also includes the adoption of technologies and practices to reduce women's work burden. I'm convinced that the future of global food security depends on unleashing their potential.
World Food Program Director Etherin Cousins says that empowering women economically is one of the key steps to realizing gender equality and achieving zero hunger. Adding to that is IFAD President Kanyayo Nwanze, who says poverty will never be overcome without empowering rural women. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
16 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, despite the election of a new president and the end of a political crisis, the Gambia is engulfed in deep political divisions and tensions are rising. Adama Barrow recently took office and longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh has left the country. Reporter Madu Juf has more on the story from Banjul.
Buyam is a small town in the west coast region of the Gambia, situated more than 100 kilometers from Banjul. It is home to more than 5,000 people, but the population here is deeply divided along political lines. Some neighbors are not in speaking terms since the post-election crisis. Usman Kamara is a presenter at the Buyam Community Radio.
It's like what the others are claiming. The others from the opposition side, that's the coalition side. What they're saying is that they've been provoked for 22 years during Jammeh's rule. So now is the time for revenge. Anyone who puts on Jammeh's t-shirt, you know, will be insulted or will be throwing words that will hurt that person. To express your feeling is accepted, but in a civilized manner. You cannot just go and stand in front of somebody's compound uttering insults or making words that will hurt that individual.
The chief of Buyam, Lamin Tombong Baji, agreed. He said there have been quarrels between supporters of ex-president Yahya Jammeh and current president Adama Barrow. Since the political crisis, he said, I have been receiving complaints. There were quarrels. Wherever there is change, some people will be sad and others will be happy. That is something we can't avoid. Some people are still not talking to each other, especially the women. They take this issue seriously. I am taking measures to keep this village united by engaging the Council of Elders in Buyam. The Buyam Community Radio, which broadcasts to 7 districts in that region, is using talk shows and phone-in programs to call for peaceful coexistence. Radio presenter Usman Kamara explained.
You can see families been separated or neighbors have been separated. So I deem it necessary to conduct such programs in the radio. The messages I sent is just like the reconciliation, you understand, and building peace and making peace, maintaining the peace, not a building itself because it has been there, but how to maintain it. And I open lines, you know, to for people to contribute because they are the people affected. Some people will contribute positively, but others will contribute negatively. That is life. The main purpose of this program is to change the negative attitude.
However, the Buyam problem is just a fraction of a wider national problem of political division. On February 20, 51 people, including 26 children, were arrested in the West Coast region village of Kamfenda, President Jammeh's stronghold, over allegations of provoking President Barrow's supporters into a fight. Dr. Ismaila Cisse, a political analyst and a lecturer at the University of The Gambia, said the nation has never been so divided.
One of the key challenges is to unite the nation. I've always been emphasizing that the nation, Gambian nation, has never, never, ever before been so divided along both political and tribal lines. If you look at the past election results, it indicates that the Fula candidate, which is Mama Kande, won almost in all the Fula constituencies. The Manika candidate, Boro, won in almost all the Manika constituencies. And the Jola candidate, Yajam, won in all the Jola constituencies. And that's a clear indication that the tribal factor is still an important equation in Gambian politics. But as it stands now, the tensions are high. The tribal differences, they are very apparent, and some people are angry here and there.
President Adama Barrow is yet to deliver on his promise to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission following his election. He also promised to be the president of all Gambians, especially those in the former ruling party. Hope he keeps up to that promise. But Tuesday's detention of a single mother, accused of insulting the president, has left many in doubt. Some critics said the mass arrest of ordinary Gambians is no different from the trend set in Yahya Jammeh's 22 years of repression. For VOA, this is Modi Diouf reporting from Banjul, The Gambia.
South Africa's government has officially revoked its notice of intent to withdraw from the International Criminal Court at The Hague. But the fight goes on, as the matter will now be debated in Parliament. Top international jurists have presented an argument to Parliament as to why South Africa should stay. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Former Constitutional Court Justice Zak Yacoub says he is finding little to celebrate in the revocation of South Africa's intent to leave the International Criminal Court. A top South African court ruled last month that the notice, given by South Africa's cabinet, was unconstitutional, and that the matter needs to go through Parliament.
Ultimately, it doesn't matter in real substantial terms whether we leave the process by not having followed the proper process, or whether we leave having followed the proper process. I suppose the first is marginally worse, but in the end, our view is that whether we follow the process or not, leaving will have catastrophic international consequences.
Yacoub is one of six retired justices who have signed on to a submission from the International Commission of Jurists urging South Africa's parliament to remain in the court. The ruling African National Congress, however, holds a strong majority and is firmly in favor of leaving. South Africa announced its intent to leave the court in 2015 amid disagreement with the court after South Africa declined to act on an ICC arrest warrant for Sudan's president during an African Union summit he attended in Johannesburg. African nations have frequently accused the International Criminal Court of targeting Africans. The court disputes this charge and notes it is investigating situations in a number of countries. But the ICC has yet to try a case from a non-African nation. The African Union last month voted that it would support any member who wanted to withdraw from the War Crimes Court. So far, only Burundi and South Africa have announced they will do so after Gambia's new president reversed the previous president's decision to withdraw. Arnold Sunga, director of the Africa Regional Program of the International Commission of Jurists, says the court is not perfect. Many critics say it is inefficient. Others say the court's reliance on the United Nations Security Council, which is allowed to refer cases to the court, is problematic, since three of the five permanent members of the council do not belong to the International Court themselves. But he says that as a leading democracy with a respected legal system, South Africa can play a better role reforming it from within.
Coming out of the ICC rather than reforming it and making it more efficient and fit for purpose in terms of tackling impunity is not the way to go. And I think it's not desirable on the African continent to have South Africa leading only a country like Burundi in the pursuit of impunity. I find that to be most unfortunate, because there is absolutely no way, no way at all, that Burundi and government and the danger that it presents to its own civilians can be a country that can be in the same league as South Africa.
Yacoub says he will not give up, whatever Parliament decides. The brief submitted by top jurists warns that if South Africa pulls out of the court, it will have no other legitimate venue to try serious international crimes.
The parliament takes the decision to leave now. That for us, I think, is not the end of the matter. Because then begins the campaign to persuade the country to join again. So ultimately, this is not a campaign which has an end. It doesn't end at the point where Parliament makes its decision, even if it decides against us. We will continue with this campaign until there is victory.
Parliament is set to discuss the matter Wednesday, but the end of this debate in South Africa appears far away indeed. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In the U.S., the Trump administration is doing something the Obama administration did not when it comes to terrorism. It's using the words radical Islamic terrorism. Critics say the term wrongly attacks Islam itself. At the same time, some Republican members of Congress are pushing for the Muslim Brotherhood to be declared a terrorist group. It's one of the most influential groups in the Arab world and has individual chapters in many countries. Mokhtar Awad is a research fellow at George Washington University's program on extremism. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the possibility of the Muslim Brotherhood being declared a terrorist organization.
To be honest, at the moment, it's not specifically clear what the administration's intentions are. The talk that did come out was from circles around them. However, there hasn't been an explicit executive order drafted or circulated. It's possible that the administration will probably try to look for a designation on a chapter-by-chapter basis, but as of right now, it's not necessarily clear if it's coming up.
But how could such designation impact U.S. relations with supporters of such move like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, and on the other side, countries where Brotherhood-affiliated parties are in power like Turkey, Tunisia, and Morocco?
It would definitely be polarizing. I think this is perhaps one of the reasons why the administration has held off potentially designating the entire organization as terrorist as opposed to certain chapters. And definitely, if there is somehow a blanket designation, this will put us in a precarious situation in dealing with Morocco and Tunisia, for instance, where there are Brotherhood members in the government there. Also, as you pointed out, Turkey and Qatar are prominent supporters of that organization on a regional level. This is why I think we're possibly going to see a specific case-by-case, country-by-country designation. In either case, this will, of course, be welcomed by some of our allies who've already made that move, but also some partners in the region, including Turkey, might be against it. But at the end of the day, these designations do have to come down at what the United States sees as its own national security priorities.
If there are two options available to the Trump administration, either a blanket designation against all Brotherhood-affiliated groups or designate specific ones that resorted to terrorism, which option is more viable?
I believe the latter option is far more viable for this administration because it has to fit through specific legal criterions. But most importantly, even if there isn't a designation, I think this is about a change of posture in how the United States conducts its foreign policy towards these Islamist groups. And so I believe this will be the most important lasting effect, that more likely than not, we won't be engaging with Islamist groups in the region, and we will perceive them, as many would like to do, as part of the larger problem of extremism in the Middle East. So I think this will be the most lasting impact of just the talk of designating the MB, whether it actually happens or not. That's a specific legal issue that we may see resolved in the next couple of months.
Mokhtar Awad is a research fellow at George Washington University's program on extremism. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss International Women's Day. It's also known as the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace, celebrating women's achievements throughout history. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.